The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Hello. As always on a Thursday morning, if the voice speaking into your ears is me, Claire Williamson, this means you're listening to A Little Bit Booked on Fresh FM. Huzzah! As always, during this time of year, it feels like the literary award lists and festivals and long lists and short lists and programs and workshops are coming thick and fast, and honestly, I cannot keep up, which is why in this attention economy, I appreciate a considered deep dive even more. So coming to chat with me today is Josie Shapiro, the best-selling author of Everything is Beautiful and Everything Hurts, which won the inaugural Allen and Unwin Fiction Prize. A graduate of the University of Auckland's Master of Creating Writing, she was a Sargeson Fellow in 2024 and was named one of the 2025 New Voices of Aotearoa. Kia ora, Josie.
Kia ora, Claire. Thank you so much for having me on today.
I'm very curious. What is being a new voice of Aotearoa? What does that mean?
Yeah, it was a new initiative run by the Coalition for Books, which is an industry-led coalition to help drive the book industry. It's publishers, booksellers, the New Zealand Society of Authors. They came together and they ran their very first New Voices promotion last year. And I believe that there'll be an announcement some point in the near future for the 2026 New Voices. And it's to help drive engagement and readership of New Zealand authors.
Was there anything, you know, was it a surprise to be popped into this list?
It was, you know, it's really lovely to be acknowledged when you are working in isolation quite a lot. You know, so much of the work is on your own. So anything like those things where you are given a little bit of validation that maybe you're on the right track is always welcome.
And on that note, and it doesn't have to be a contemporary title, but what have you been reading recently?
Oh, what have I been reading recently that I've really loved? Well, recently I am looking forward to reading the next volume in the On the Calculation of Volume series. So this is a fourth edition of the, I think there's seven in total.
Oh.
The fourth is going to be coming out soon and translated into English from the Danish. I'm really excited to read that. It's a beautiful meditation on time and change and personality, sort of told through the story of a woman who keeps waking up on the 18th of November, a little bit like Groundhog Day.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I think that would drive me slowly insane.
Yes, so you sort of go through these waves of her feeling sort of manic with possibility about how to change her situation, and then periods of time in which she's quite melancholic and philosophical about what it actually means to continue living this way in a world that slowly depletes from her presence but doesn't really change in any way. It's very interesting, beautifully written book, actually. Yeah.
Do you know when it first came out? Because it feels like the sort of thing where in the middle of the pandemic, I wouldn't have been able to read that. But now maybe that's the kind of time we could all start coming back to those sort of meditations.
Ooh, I don't know when the first one came out in Danish. The original series, I believe, was self-published in Danish by Solveig Balle, I think her name is pronounced. And I think she's written seven, but only four in English. And the English translations started coming out about 2 years ago.
Okay.
So it possibly could have been during the pandemic, actually, you're right, when they started coming out in Danish, and which it would have been a really
trippy.
Yeah, very trippy sort of read, because you would have seen some unusual parallels between your real life. That is interesting.
Okay, but I'm very, very intrigued. Is there anything from Aotearoa you're reading or have on your TBR?
Oh, what's on my TBR? I listened to your interview with Aorana Nga Rewa the other day, and I have his latest, The Last Living Cannibal, on my TBR pile. That will be one of the next Aotearoa writers that I read.
Oh, you've got a chat coming up with him, don't you?
I do, at the Featherston Booktown. There'll be an event with Aorana, Dominic Hui, Tracy Farr, and myself, talking about writing the past into life today in Aotearoa New Zealand.
That is a powerhouse lineup. You are one of the powerhouses.
Oh, it feels very strange to hear yourself described that way, but you know, it is a real incredible honor to be included in these panels with people of such great, you know, like you said, powerhouses, you know, people who are writing important, interesting, fresh works, like Tracy Farr with her Wonderland and the two novels by Dominic and Erana. Yeah, it's going to be very exciting. I can't wait.
Oh, how fascinating. I wish I could listen into that. Oh, it'll be so good. But that's a lovely segue into getting to talk about your fresh, wonderful, and exciting work. And, you know, no surprises for anyone. I loved both of your novels. I thought they were
Thank you. They
were wonderful. So we're going to attempt to have a theme-focused but largely plot spoiler-free discussion of your second book, Good Things Come and Go, which is sometimes, you know, it's hard to strike that balance. We'll do our best. So cue official synopsis for anyone who hasn't gotten to read it yet. After the death of their young daughter, Penny Whitaker and Adam Riggs are struggling. Penny with her lifelong dream of becoming an artist, Riggs with his waning professional skateboarding career, and they're given a chance to come back to Aotearoa, and despite some reservations, they accept. And then at the same time, Jamie Flannery has found himself suddenly out of work, and at his uncle's abandoned batch on the Coromandel, and then his childhood friend Riggs, Small World. Classic. Two points of connection in New Zealand, calls out of the blue, and the three friends reunite, and then everything happens.
Everything happens.
What I love about both of your books is how three-dimensional every character is. This was definitely the case with Mickey, and Everything is Beautiful and Everything Hurts. But it's also the case with Penny and Adam. They've got motivations and desires and flaws that feel realistic and believable. How do you go about building this kind of perfectly imperfect, real person?
I think character is probably my number one thing that I'm going for in my fiction writing. I very first thing it starts with is the name. It's very important for me to get the name that feels right and feels like a good connection to the character. And from then it becomes this quite in-depth and emotional, a sort of psychological challenge of really finding the part of finding who they could be if I was them, you know, sort of really giving them sort of a bodily feeling of me imagining this possibility. What would I do if I was this person? How could I engage in this world? What are the things that are irritating me? I don't sort of, some writers talk about writing a character list about, you know, do you know what they had for breakfast that morning? But I don't always know that sort of information, but I'm very interested in, you know, the when you put a character under pressure, in what ways are they going to behave?
So you don't know what they had for breakfast, but you know how they would react if they dropped the milk on the ground.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. That's sort of the place exactly where the tension happens. In that novels often and fiction often, it sort of revolves around these moments of conflict, whether they're external or internal, whether they're a big conflict or a very minor conflict, how characters are reacting and what these events mean to them. I saw a quote from George Saunders, who discussed this idea of character being sort of this deep psychological exercise, and how he talked about how emotionally exhausting it can be. I'm sort of paraphrasing him here, but I really resonated with that because especially after I finished Good Things Come and Go, it was such a almost like an emotional hangover. I really felt this deep loss of the time spent imagining them. So I'm hoping that sort of very, very deep emotional energy that I'm giving to these characters I'm so pleased that it feels satisfying and real on the page to readers. That's, you know, that it makes that sort of effort quite, it's very gratifying and lovely to know that they feel real, because it really, they do. I give them space in my head like they're real people. Yeah.
I'm fascinated by this mention of name, because I can kind of imagine you going, Sarah, no, that doesn't sound very good. Like, Rebecca, no, no, no. But as soon as you said, you know, kind of name is destiny, Penny popped into my head as, you know, kind of flip a coin, heads or tails. Penny.
Mm.
Big pivotal choices. In many, many respects, which would be spoiler related if I said too much of them. But I love that kind of retroactive connection. I don't know if it was intentional or not, but...
Yeah, and it is funny that sometimes those things, they become... And many things within fiction writing have that sort of feeling of intentionality that's even surprising to the writer further down the track, and you realise there's these little weird moments of subconscious thought that are coming out through the work that you may not even realise at the time, and how readers make these connections. I think that classic case of readers figuring out that the handmaid in The Handmaid's Tale must be named June because she was the only person who didn't show up again after the list in the front. And even Margaret Atwood said, oh, well, you know, I must have done that, but I didn't. You know, it's quite incredible, the brain and the those deep urges coming through.
And I think another thing about that is when you have a real character, there's unlikable bits about them. And, you know, I think that the trick is to not take them too far into the realm of caricature. Because once someone's so unlikable, it's impossible to ever see yourself in them again, because there's no way you could be that horrible. So you kind of just, you can hand wave a lot of their, the lessons that you might be taking away from it. How do you know how far to go? You know, Adam has got this addiction issue and makes some bad choices, but, you know, so do all of your characters.
Yeah, I think, and I try not to read too many online reviews. I feel like the reader is having their own experience. They can say, you know, they can have their own responses. But I did look at a couple, and some people had found that he was quite unlikable. They found that quite difficult. And when I had this quite warm feeling towards him, despite it all, because I really did feel like he had some redeeming qualities. He was incredibly enthusiastic and resilient in some ways that the other characters weren't. But I sometimes I don't quite know, because I do find that in reality, people are quite awful and justify their awfulness in massive cognitive dissonance. And when you put that on the page, like you said, it's much more confronting and jarring, and people don't have as much ability to write off awfulness as they do to real people in their lives. And I didn't do a good job. It was through the editing process in my first novel, Everything is Beautiful and Everything Hurts. So many people, like the editor and then a couple of my sort of early readers, they found the father too awful, Mickey's father, Teddy. They found him really, they found it was unbelievable that someone could have that level of sort of...
disregard.
Almost, yeah, disregard and sort of, just sort of, you know, sort of unthinking cruelty. But... you know, in my experience, and people that I've known, and other people, that there can be that sort of parental cruelty in that way. But on the page, it's a little bit like when people talk about curse words, swear words on the page, that they're much more powerful than they are in real life. That one on a page is super powerful. You can't, whereas in real life, you could hear someone curse several times in a paragraph. So there is a balance. That I think that sometimes that's where your readers can help out. That they can give you the idea and say, you need to shade this. You need to give, you know, maybe there's some shading here. And I think I learned a lot from the first novel and really brought those lessons to Riggs, because I knew that his character would have need to have that shading, that sort of as well-rounded, which it was so difficult. In the first early drafts, he was a very vague character. I spent a lot of time working on his voice and how to make him an interesting and vital part of the work.
Well, yeah, because on one hand, he's got immense attachment to family and immense ambition and immense talent, and scrapped himself up from, you know, being in a small town in New Zealand to being a global superstar. But at the other end, like the dual-edged sword of that ambition is, what are you willing to sacrifice to to get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sort of that sacrifice, which is similar, you know, it's an idea of that I look at in both books, that sort of that idea of what does it take and who do you hurt along the way, and what are other lessons do you miss out on due to this sort of quite obsessive interest in one thing. I think, you know, and I think that especially in terms of physical pursuits, the amount of time it takes to be really, really good at these things is unique in a sense, you know, that I think musical instruments probably similar, but it's, again, it's a physical thing. It's a performance, it's a movement to learn an instrument. So I just think those things in which it's bodily movement do take a long time. And what, like you said, what are the sacrifices? What are the things that you might miss if you're so focused?
Yeah. I had not at the professional level that either Riggs or Mickey were, but I do know, you know, I competed in tennis, you know, every weekend when I was a kid. It was, you know, it was local tournaments, regional tournaments. Mm-hmm. And then it did eventually get to a point kind of around high school. It was like, right, how far do I want to keep trying? And I was never going to be professional, like, no. But, you know, there's always more you could try and push yourself. And it kind of was like, all right, mm-hmm. do I keep doing weekend tournaments? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, school and kind of other activities. And I mean, I still play and I still compete, but I do recall making that conscious decision at some point. Are you sporty?
That's actually, very, kind of quite an eerily similar story, that I was a competitive swimmer. And that's a lot of swimming, you know, that's early mornings, evenings, many, many hours, many, many kilometers, and a lot of weekend competitions, going to other towns within the country, traveling a lot. And I think I must have been about 18 when I had to make that same decision within myself, because I had been chasing this sort of Commonwealth Games, possibly Olympics. You know, that was my sort of end goal.
Oh my God, cool.
But, you know, you start to realize, oh, I'm 17, 18. I'm not really achieving the levels that it would be needed in order to go on to that next step. And is all this time that it's taking, you know, I was falling asleep at school in some of my classes because I was so tired from the trainings. You know, you're going to school after swimming 7 or 8 kilometers before anyone else has had breakfast. And I do remember thinking that it was taking these things, and there were other things that I was missing out on, and that I needed to make a decision. And I think that you do, you sometimes do have to make a choice. You can't do everything. You have to follow one path and see where that takes you. And but it's also a good lesson to sort of think that it's never too late to take a different one. If you decide to change, it's not too late to start something new. At any age.
Flip a coin.
So important. Yeah, flip a coin. Anything can happen today. Anything can happen tomorrow.
So, I mean, I can definitely then see that tension, particularly with Mickey, you know, you drawing on those experiences. But in both books, the sporting elements are not swimming. They're running and they're skateboarding.
Yeah. I loved the narrative that I thought was quite inherent in long distance running, just within watching it as on the television. There was just such a drama in it. I loved that idea. I read a really good swimming book called by Christos Tsolkas, Barracuda. And I thought that was quite a well done swimming novel. And when you mentioned tennis, I thought, there's been a couple of really good tennis novels. Infinite Jest is a tennis, I would consider that a tennis novel. Another one, I forget what it's called, but it's by Lionel Shriver. She's also written a tennis novel.
I don't know that one.
Yeah, so I've read a couple of tennis novels, and I hadn't read a good running novel with a female character. And I don't know much about if there's any other skateboarding books with skateboarders in them, but I loved that there was this sort of, I loved the idea of the risk involved in doing something. It's, you know, it's massively risky. And once I started to explore that idea of risk, I just, you know, it became so obvious to me that the biggest risks, the ones that have the most potential to cause damage, is just loving someone else. You know, it isn't jumping there. It isn't doing a flip on a skateboard. It's, you know, it's opening yourself up and being vulnerable. And it just seemed beautiful to explore those ideas in fiction.
I like, and I think as someone else who didn't know that much about skateboarding either, but what I did kind of have in mind was Tony Hawk. And I feel like a lot of people, you know, that elder millennial, you know, maybe I don't know what Gen Alpha or anything knows anymore, but you know, Tony Hawk and his kind of watching him grow literally and figuratively through and out of his career was, I think, an image we could all latch quite on to. There are lots of parallels I found in Good Things.
Yeah, and I, another one that I really remember from around that time was a lot of people were playing like those PlayStation games about snowboarding as well as, but you know, there was a snowboarding
Sean
game.
Sean White. Everyone knew Sean White, red hair, and snowboarding games.
You know, just sort of thought, oh, you know, that I just loved the idea of these guys and what it might mean to inhabit this sort of world that seems a little bit outsider. You know, it's rebellious. It's an unusual masculinity, but hyper masculine all the same. I think that skateboarding is only really now sort of changing and having a much more stronger presence for females and other people. You know, there's some incredible young woman skaters coming out. Chloe Cavell and Riesa Leal. But I did like that idea of discovering these characters through this world that was like, yeah, it was just, yeah, it was like you said, a sort of a keystone of a millennial experience in many ways.
How did you do your research? Were you going down to the local skate park and just watching people, or?
I did go to some skate parks sometimes. It was, you know, you don't want to be too creepy. My youngest daughter was taking skateboarding lessons, which were run by a group of sort of young quintessential guys. And that was almost where the idea of having characters who were skateboarding came to play, because I was worried about her hurting herself, obviously, because it's, you know, I stood on her skateboard once and just about broke my arm, you know. Mm. I thought, oh, how do you teach someone to do something like this? And they turn up and they're young and they're baggy pants, and they were incredible. The juxtaposition between the way they looked and then the way that they were able to be so gentle and caring and teach her, that again was an interesting idea that I wanted to play with. Sensitivity and a nurturing understanding of children, coupled with this idea of being sort of counterculture, skateboarding was really interesting idea to play around with. And then I watched a lot of YouTube, there's a lot on YouTube, lots of skating videos, and learn how to do trick videos so that I could understand how to describe them. You could watch someone teaching it and understand, and then you can pause and watch the way their bodies are arranged and what they do with their feet exactly. And I watched a lot of the Skateboarding League, which is like a competition that tours around the world, mostly in the United States, and just watched them do the crazy tricks. And I become quite obsessive in my research. I got really interested in how to skateboard and how to paint, because Penny's a painter. It was a lot of and I can't paint with any sort of real skill, and I didn't understand the intricacies of painting and what and how it actually. How people began, like what's the knowledge? How do you know how to create the palette and to prep the canvas? So I watched a lot of things and read a lot of books about art actually, which was really quite a lot of fun.
I think in many respects you've picked pursuits where there's an elusive perfection just out of sight. You know, there's in running, there's your personal best or a record or the theoretical fastest. In skateboarding, there's nailing the tricks and there's getting one more rotation, and then in art, it's, you know, there's whatever you trying to express on the canvas. I know this is quite a controversial question in some circles, but in this pursuit, where do kind of the sport pursuit of perfection and the artistic pursuit of perfection, where do they come together for you?
Oh, I think that they I think that they are more alike than they are dissimilar. I think, and I tried to explore that sort of idea of that they were, you know, very closely related in my first novel, Everything is Beautiful and Everything Hurts, by having Mickey and a character she gets to know, Niall, explore those ideas that some of the things, you know, people talk a lot about how important reading is, and I completely agree. I mean, reading is the greatest joy of my life. But I also think that a lot of the beautiful things that you can learn, the empathy and the understanding of life, can be learned in other ways through other pursuits, including sports. That before we talked about the things you're missing out on learning, but I also think that there's plenty of things that you learn about yourself and others through, I guess, a pursuit of perfection, which is this, you know, a similar drive to the pursuit in creative arts. And I also liked the idea of using both the sports or sort of physical activity as a in a metaphorical way in both of the books. But also I didn't see them as something that was unusual in a sense. Even though sports and literature can sometimes have this division, because I think that, you know, I could have changed it out in both instances for something like ballet or learning the cello, and could have had the same, almost very similar storylines in many ways. And maybe it wouldn't have drawn that same sort of thing of, you know, that it is the sports novels. To me, they're about living life, you know, that sort of type one fun of actually the things that you do with yourself and your brain and your body in the world. Yeah. So, and I just find that, I think that in a way I chose them. I love describing scenes and writing scenes of people in movement, in action, and those sorts of things come bring a lot of that. So I was, you know, leaning into my possibly the things that I'm good at in my writing. Yeah.
Have you kept any of the paintings you attempted?
No, I'm not. I wish I was more talented. My maternal grandfather was a really beautiful painter. He painted Australian landscapes and really beautiful scenes of bush and gum tree, eucalypts, and stunning pieces of work. But I just don't have. I can do cute doodles, but I'm not a real artist.
Yeah, like a real artist.
Yeah, not in that sense. Mm. Not in that sort of visual art. Mm. Yeah. No, unfortunately.
And I think as part of as well, watching the characters in your books struggle and challenge themselves, a lot of them come up to literal and figurative blocks where they have to figure out where to go to next from here. And for Penny, it's kind of artist block of a variety. Mm-hmm. And for Jamie, it's an injury. And for Riggs, it's kind of aging and facing your own, I don't want to say irrelevancy, but, you know, recognizing that, yeah.
That word plays a part into his fear, I think, because he's unable to understand where he can go next. You know, he's poured so much time and put himself into that and that idea of getting to an age. And I think that that's particularly important with these physical livelihoods when we do things. Even when you're just an amateur, you know, you have this, you know, you go to this exercise class, or you're an amateur runner, or you like to play squash, and then you have an injury, and this thing that was quite good for your mental health and your physical health and was a hobby and something you enjoyed, and then you are curtailed. It can be quite a very low level type of grief and a really difficult time, I think, for just about anyone. But I think for a professional whose livelihood was that, it's just a really, must be quite overwhelming to move through that, and there's sort of this double layer of grief for him with not really understanding or having the ability to move on from his daughter's death. Yeah,
because he was teaching her how to skateboard as well.
And she was, yeah, and that was, you know, like a big bond for them, something that he was responsible, and that he cared for her and could teach her. And then he's, you know, dealing with this, this sort of feeling of guilt that he wasn't able to help her more. And it was really, really sad to write about these sad things, actually, now thinking back on it. I'm thinking, oh, these poor characters.
What have you done to them?
I'm thinking, made it so hard for them. But, you know, that it was... I really wanted to explore how people, you know, it's inevitable, these incredibly awful things that are going to come for all of us, you know, these sadnesses, these hardships, these losses, and that it felt very urgent to me to really think how would these characters, who felt like you said, could be people I know, could be my friends living around the corner, how can we move through these times? How can we deal with these griefs? These griefs, these big griefs, the little ones, the changing of our lives, facing our own irrelevancy, I guess, yeah.
And your answer was to put them in a tiny cabin and shake them together.
I did. It was sort of my very first instinct was to say, okay, I'm going to have these three sort of friends reunite after 20 years in a isolated batch, you know, on a beach in the Coromandel. And I thought it might have a real pressure cooker type feeling. That was my sort of idea, was to really give the book this feeling of a building up of pressure. And I knew that if it was sort of three friends of mine that I hadn't seen in 2 decades, how would that go? You know, it would just be such a weird mix of nostalgia and familiarity coupled with a real strangeness and an unknowability of each other. And that was a lot of fun, even though it was difficult to keep the excitement going with just three characters there, but it was a good challenge.
Well, I mean, in many respects, it's like when you've gone back to your childhood neighborhood and 95% of the things are the same and then 5% is different, and it feels like you've stepped into a parallel universe almost. Yeah. And so you feel like you should recognize these people completely who were their best friend, you know, they were best friends as a kid. Mm. You get the flashbacks of them and their connections to each other. It feels like every other day also we read stories online about how just about every single generation struggles with loneliness and lack of connection and the inability to maintain friendships. And so I did wonder if any of that was present in your mind while you wrote their reunion.
Yeah, I do often think about sort of, yeah, why, how I see, you know, you have people that you see on Facebook, people maybe that you knew from school or from university, and maybe they're still really close, but you're no longer a part of that. And you think, how did that, you know, how did that happen? What was it, my, you know, how did I drop out from that? Was that me? Was that something else? What was the, you know, what was the, how did those friendships dissolve? How when they were once so strong, how do those things change? Why do they change? Is it really just absence through living in different places? And what does that say about, like you said, what does that say about what friendship means to us as humans? I do find that very interesting, that idea of proximity and how that strengthens connections between people. So it was very much forefront of my mind, this idea of what would it be like to meet up with these people you've essentially lost contact with, that you were once so close with, that you thought that you would, you know, end up in a rest home together and be living there forever for the rest of your lives. But then suddenly 20 years have passed and you think, oh, I no longer know these people. And then you don't have a good sense either. I mean, I think I found hard for myself when I'm writing it, thinking of the ways that Riggs and Jamie let each other down. And how do you move on from that? You know, they both continually had let each, they had, and then I think that's just a very human, you know, a real part of human friendships is this sort of constant inability to always be what everyone else needs. We can't always be exactly what someone needs in that instance. So that was an interesting idea to explore.
Do you, then this may be a leading question, but do you think kind of the way men can let each other down is different than the way women can let each other down?
Ooh, potentially, because I think that the expectations in friendship are different. The way that females in friendship and males are expected to show up for each other is different socially, you know, socialized differently. And I don't know whether that's sort of inherent or if it's completely socialized. I don't know. You know, that's quite interesting to me. Is there other changes and differences between friendships and genders that way? Is it inherent or is it learned behavior? But they do have different expectations and different ways in which the relationship is kept strong.
Mm.
Definitely, you know, I can see the way that my husband keeps his friendships going is different to the way that I would maintain friendships and the way that things work.
Mm.
But I think that deep down, on a very basic level, I saw an author, Lucy Hone, talking about the other day on her, she talks about resilient living and resilient grieving. And she said, you know, do you know who your 3 a.m. people are? And I think that if you were to apply that across the board, there would be no difference in the way friendships between genders would work, because I think that at the end of the day is the very core basic tenet of love and care and support for each other. And that when you, even if you had a 400 acquaintances, everyone possibly only has this very small set of 3 a.m. friends. And I like to think about that. I think, are Jamie and Riggs the 3 a.m. friends? Or are they not? You know, and I don't know if I know that. I think that the questions that
I don't know if they know that either.
No, they might, and they might like to think that they do, but then is that real? Do they know that for sure? I think that Jamie would feel more like he wasn't sure, but I think Riggs would be like, of course. But then he would never...
He wouldn't actually call, though.
Well, he would never call.
No.
He would never call.
He would be like, I can do it. I'm fine.
Yeah, so... But if someone asked him that question, he'd say, well, of course, it's this person. But then he may not be awake to answer the phone. He'd put his phone on mute, right?
Yeah.
So I think that, it is an interesting idea.
And I think Penny would first call Riggs. But then if he didn't answer, she'd immediately call Jamie.
Yeah.
And be okay with that.
I think so. And he would answer.
Mm.
And that I think, sort of idea...
The idea, kind of what we owe our childhood friends, what we think we owe them, different things maybe.
Mm. Yeah. I think it's an interesting question, isn't it? That what do we owe these people who are with us? When are they essentially siblings? You know, they felt like they were raised like siblings. In which case, what is the filial duty to one another? It's you know, that idea of duty to others. Is something that I tried to sort of have the book be interested in and explore. You know, there's a conversation between Riggs and Jamie about that very thing, about what do we owe the people in our lives, and there's that idea that we owe one another a lot. You know, we can't really survive independently, but that's also, you know, we live such a especially the Western world. You know, we live this sort of independently minded thing that, well, it's my one life. How am I going to be, you know, how do I want to spend it? I want to do all these things, and I only, you know, why would I let something or someone else inhibit that? I mean, it really depends on the, I don't know. I don't even know how to answer it. I guess that's why I spent the book trying to.
I know the whole book was you attempting to answer this question. I guess as an illustrative example, you know, you have, there were Penny's parents who, in some respects, gave her everything that the parental relationship was, you know, supposed to do, you know, money and education and opportunities. And then there was her relationship with, which in its own respect, her relationship with her parents was not fulfilling or what she needed. And then as her husband, you know, Riggs was the provider, and that was what he thought he owed her, was, you know, money and security and this loving relationship. And so then I guess the tension, as you said earlier, was what happens when you can't meet the expectations you think you're supposed to be meeting. And then do you keep trying, or do you again make a different choice?
That is, you know, that we do, you know, that we owe and have expectations of each other, and that's a natural and important contract. But that, you know, what point, like you said, what point do we say this is not working, and when is it okay, when that is that not okay? You know, sort of, I really thought a lot about how different sort of issues, like take the issue, I mean, of something like infidelity, that when you put one narrative lens on it, it can be interpreted in one way, and if you put a different narrative lens on it, you understand it in another way. And that I was interested in that sort of, in that nuanced area where, depending on your understanding of things, that are either continuing to remain and trying to meet that expectation and the duty to each other is good, but so is leaving, and so is making a change, and so is being true to yourself. It's a sliding doors sort of moment, isn't it? It's that both decisions might have merit and have value and be good choices, but you really have to just make one and live with that, I suppose.
Yeah. I feel like we've teased lots of listeners with all these big themes, and all I can say is, you know, they're going to have to read it to find out.
I hope they read and enjoy, and now if you listen to this and then read it and think of some of the thing, you know, some of the ideas and the themes that it's trying to bring out, that would be interesting readership to do that in that way. Yeah.
So the kind of the last thing I wanted to ask before going into our wrap up is, both book titles, or at least one book title and one book dedication, heavily riff on quotes. And the one for Good Things Come and Go is one that's on a Fangamata skate park. Hurting now does not mean your future holds pain. So it's just, if you had any quote at all on that, I thought that would be interesting.
I was in Fangamata looking at the skate park. It would have been in December for 2024. And I'm desperately trying to finish the manuscript because I'm past my deadline. I have a new deadline of the end of January, you know, and it's like the weekend before Christmas, and then there's New Year's, my kids are off school and we go camping. You know, I just knew that if I didn't get it done now, it was going to be incredibly difficult to finish it in January. And I was walking around and looking at the skate park, and then when I saw that, I actually have a photo of that exact quote on the skate park. And it was just such a crazy, weird synchronicity to what I had been thinking about and working with, and yeah, like unraveling in the book for a couple of years, and then to just see it starkly written in this sort of very basic sentence. Hurting now does not mean your future will hold pain. And I just really loved that idea of some young person scrawling that out with a graffiti, with a spray can, who knows what time of day, what that meant to them, what pain was in their lives,
and why they thought other people needed to see it
exactly in that spot. And it felt you know, just like a shooting star moment of, oh, here's something powerful and real and true. And because of all those things, I hope that it wasn't trite, that it was, in fact, you know, really beautifully powerful and meaningful. And that was just a moment of, oh, okay, I felt like the book was meaningful in some way when I saw that. And I thought, oh, this is exactly where I would want these people to know that hold on, a new dawn will come, tomorrow's sky will still be there, and to hold on through those hard times.
Genuinely making me kind of tear up a little bit, I think. So it feels a little bit weird to whiplash from that into kind of the closing bookish bookmarks that I do to end every episode. But one is a reminder that the Featherston Booktown Karakatea Festival is back from 8 to 10 May with an exciting and inspiring program of big names, big ideas, and big conversations, of which you will be part of at least a couple.
Yes, I think three events, which is just
that's so much
wonderful.
Prep work.
I'm really excited. It is a lot to think about.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm really excited, but a bit of prep.
So I believe tickets, etc., are still available online for that, so people should definitely go check it out. And the other one is a bit of a personal plug for me. Sorry, guys.
That's all good.
But did you know that there's an entire indie magazine out there dedicated to cats? And it is called Catnip. Volume 2 has just come out, and I have a very cool interview with Wairarapa-based local Burton Silver in there on the 30th anniversary of his cult fave parody book, Why Cats Paint. So people should go check that out. He's a hoot. It's great. Also cats. And that is it for today. You can find me online at Accidental Tokyoite. You can find Josie online at Josie_Shapiro and catch her up at the upcoming Featherston Booktown Festival on 8 to 10 May. Oh, and of course, all her books are available where fine books are sold.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.